open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
It's a book about the bond between us and our dogs and how our dogs always have us at the center of their hearts. And if they can, they will find their way back to us.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Novelist W. Bruce Cameron says having his first story published at the age of 16 was the worst thing that could have happened to him.
I concluded, oh, this is going to be easy. Do I need to go to college? I'll just write a bestseller. It didn't happen that way.
After that first story, it took W. Bruce Cameron 25 more years to publish his first book, 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. That book was made into a sitcom on ABC. Since then, he's published 15 more books, including A Dog's Purpose, which was made into a feature film released in January 2017. W. Bruce Cameron talks this hour with WTCM News Talk 580 radio host Ron Jolly, who asked him what the W in his name stands for.
It stands for www.wbrucecameron.com.
It's all there on the web. We're going to talk a lot. Bruce has written a lot of books. You've written about things that you know, fatherhood, dogs, and Ruddy McCann, the repo man of Kalkaska, which is, sort of autobiographical. We'll get into that. And we'll find out what else might be on tap here. Give us your Northern Michigan credentials here. We've heard you were born in Petoskey. How many years in Petoskey?
Well, I don't know. I was a little kid.
So you moved away when you were a little kid.
Yeah, we moved away,
Holy Island for how many years?
Holy Island forever.
Forever.
My grandparents bought a place that was built in the 20s on Holy Island. How many people know where Holy Island is? All right, good for you. Most of you have no idea. And that's okay because it's this tiny little spit of an island between East Jordan and Charlevoix on the south arm of Lake Charlevoix. And I spent every summer of my life there and have been up here every summer of my life since.
Have you written any part of your published books on Holy Island?
I have written most of my unpublished books on Holy Island.
Maybe we'll find out about that too. At what point did W. Bruce Cameron know or suspect or have the desire that you wanted to be a writer?
I don't remember not wanting to be a writer. I always wanted to do it. And it's funny because, you know, when I was a little boy, everybody wanted to be an astronaut or a baseball player. One guy I knew wanted to be a professional dancer. And oddly, he's the only one, by the way, who got... none of my other classmates were astronauts or ball players, but he's still a professional dancer, so... But I wanted to be a writer. That's all I wanted to be. That's all I can ever remember wanting to do.
So what does that feel like? Writers have keen senses of observation. You might be the guy that's standing there quiet or sitting quietly looking at everybody else, forming ideas and notes. Was that you?
I was looking at girls.
Girls, okay.
Trying to figure them out, and I still don't understand.
All right. Now... where did you move out of Petoskey? Back to Denver or out west?
Oh, my dad was a professor of medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center in Kansas City. So went to high school there, went to college in Missouri. Then I moved back to Michigan, and I moved to Traverse City to become a repo man because that just seemed like a really logical career move. And I lived mostly in Michigan then until I moved out to Colorado in the late 80s, and then from there I moved to Los Angeles.
When did you become a writer then? When, after all these years of wanting to be a writer and repossessing cars and other odd jobs, did you actually get a paying gig?
Oh, a paying gig. I sold my first one I ever wrote at age 16. And let me tell you, it was the worst thing that could have happened to me because... I concluded, oh, this is going to be easy. Do I need to go to college? I'll just write a bestseller, you know? I thought that, like that. It didn't happen that way.
Was there pressure from your parents at all? I mean, kid says, I want to be a writer. Did they say, no, you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a banker? Did they discourage you?
I think my dad would have loved for me to have gone into the medical profession, but then when I was 4 years old, I stuck a pee up my nose and had to go to the emergency room, and I did it 3 times in 1 week. And I think he concluded after that, nah, it's not going to be. I'm not going to be a doctor.
Be a writer. All right, let's see. You started in 1995, and in 1995, I remember somebody told me about this concept of email, and that's how new it was. You started an internet blog in 1990. Well, they didn't call it a blog. You started an internet column back then. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly. I couldn't get published anyway, so I thought I'll just publish myself with this new thing called email. And back then, you did not get anything offering to enhance your mail virility or messages from gentlemen in Nicaragua or Nigeria who have $10 million that they want to transfer. That didn't happen. So
that's not real?
That's
no.
Poor Ron. Yeah. So I started this newsletter, and I started sending this thing around to people. And back then, it was kind of exciting to get email, if you can believe such a thing. And people would be, you know, Mom, I got an email. Oh, I'm so proud of you, son. And there was this thing, the Cameron Column. And at its peak, it had 50,000 subscribers in 52 countries, if you count Texas as a country.
50. And that was how soon after 1995? That's pretty good, 50,000.
You know, I'm having trouble tracking the
years
now. That's
before Facebook, before you could promote yourself?
Yes. Yeah, there was none of that.
All right. So, and did you get paid for that, or was that a freebie?
That was free.
That was a freebie, just so you could write, to an audience.
Yes.
All right. Well, the question all writers love, we'll get to it now. How is it that you write? Do you write every day? Do you sit down with a legal pad? Do you have a laptop? How do you write? And how did you write back then? Is it different?
Well, yeah. So I get up in the morning, and I immediately, the best thing to do as a writer is to start procrastinating immediately. I usually don't start the self-loathing until after lunch. Then, and I'm exhausted by that point, so I always take a nap. Once I've had a nap, I just don't feel like writing, so, and that's pretty much my process. That's how that goes.
So it wasn't that long after 1995. I don't know. I had a call from Mrs. Cameron, Monsey, and she said, you know, my son Bruce is going to be in northern Michigan this summer, and he has a new book, and you should interview him. And I got a lot of those calls for the first few years. Was she on your payroll, or how did that work out exactly?
My mother sells 1.2 books for every one person she meets. And if there's anybody here who has never bought one of my books, I want you to meet my mother, and then you'll buy at least two of them. So she absolutely, the way I remember it is that she called you repeatedly, and that you finally said, okay, if you will stop calling me, I'll let your son be on my show.
And it's been just about every summer. I mean, how many books do you have published now?
I have 16.
16 books. The first one, I believe, was 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. And I was excited because I had read that this new show was coming out with John Ritter and Rockford, James Garner, Katie Segal. And I said, you mean the guy who wrote the book that was based on? Back it was based on a column. So tell us how that came about, a newspaper column that wound up being a if not a top 10, certainly a top 20 TV show.
It just turned out that it turns out that my whole career is based on stating the obvious. It's pretty obvious that fathers have a bit of a difficulty adjusting to the idea that their daughters might start dating. And it's something that fathers feel like they can control, which is not possible. So, but I was just thinking about what would the rules be if I could say these are the rules for dating my teenage daughter, and I wrote the column, and it went. There was no virality in terms of things going out there on the internet, but it did that in the newspapers. It got picked up by newspapers all over, not just the country, but all over the world. And so I knew I had something. I knew I had a hot idea.
Did you promote that then and seek a book contract or a TV show, or did people hunt you down? How did it all unfold?
I did have an agent. I lived in Denver at the time, and I had an agent, and she took it to a bunch of publishers, and one of them picked it up.
Let's do a book.
let's do a book on this.
Yeah. And then the TV show, they came knocking on your door, or did the agent pursue that?
No, that was an email that just arrived out of the blue, a guy that worked for Disney on the movie side, picked up my book in the airport, and then his flight got canceled. And because his flight got canceled, he read my book, and he wrote me an email and said, have you ever thought of turning this into a movie? And I wrote, that's the plan. what am I going to say? No. So they hired me to write the screenplay, and then they also subsequently developed it as a TV show.
So, but there was no movie, right?
No. At one point, we were going to do something that had never been done, which is to have a movie come out based on a TV show that was currently on the air. But then John died, and that changed everything.
And that was a great show. It's amazing what writers do in 22 minutes, which is how long a sitcom is, to develop a theme and move the viewer and close it all down, plus a lot of laughs.
You write the opening joke, and then it's like, well, we better start winding this up.
Exactly, yeah. Did you meet Ritter during that process?
Yeah.
What kind of guy was he?
There are people on television that appear on television to be very nice people, and then when you meet them in real life, you realize that they're just terrible people. I'm sure there's plenty of morning DJs that are like that as well. John Ritter was the nicest guy, and when we were taping the pilot and he came out onto the floor to ask the director a question, and the audience had already been seated, and the audience burst into applause, and the look he gave at the audience was, you're applauding for me? And this is a guy that, you know, he'd had a hit TV show for years, is very famous, and yet he was so genuine, he just couldn't believe people would spontaneously applaud for his arrival on stage.
And he died, and normally that would be the end of the show, yet it carried on. I think they moved Garner, was Grandpa, and they moved him into more of a prominent role. So that said a lot about the idea, I think, there.
Yeah, it was a very popular show, and then they canceled it after the first year without John, because they just couldn't understand how they could ever sell it in the syndication, because it basically was two shows, one with a dad, one without a dad. Although it turned out that they did sell it into syndication, and it has been running all over the world ever since. It's still running to this day. I think it's in 20 countries right now. Some of them running it twice.
I'm always curious about the economics without personal details, but do you benefit from that if a show is still running as the guy that had the concept?
I personally got $5 trillion. I did not benefit from.
Really?
No, I didn't. So.
So you're the guy that had the brainstorm, and they used that. Did you?
Do you have to keep rubbing this in? I didn't get any money. Okay, let's move on.
You need a new agent there. Well, how did that change your life, though? Going from an unknown, no, from a little, from a columnist in Kansas, or were you Colorado at that time?
I was in Denver. Yeah.
Denver. And now you get this column that's all over the world, and they want to make a movie. They make a television show. It's John Ritter. It's primetime. You're doing interviews with people like me all over the country. Now, how did that change your life then, as far as the exposure, and what was it like? Did you promote? Did you have to do a lot of interviews?
And
was your mom's life changed?
I became an utter stuck-up bastard.
Yeah, it happens to the best of them. Oliver North. So you did media, though. I understand. Did you go on the Oliver North had some type of radio show?
Yeah. So Oliver North. What happened with Eight Simple Rules? And you can kind of understand how this happens in the world of the internet. It was so new, and you'd get something passed along to you. And if you're like most people, you're accustomed to hearing a joke and then telling the joke, and it doesn't feel like you've taken any intellectual property. You heard a joke and you repeated it. A column, I would think, is long enough that you'd recognize it's not a joke. It's actually it's an essay. But still, people would take my column, put their name on it, and pass it around as something that they had written. And one day, I get an email from a fan who said, hey, did you know that Oliver North has Oliver North's 8 Simple Rules for Dating His Teenage Daughter? So I went, sure enough, I saw that. So I thought, well, what am I going to do about this? So I wrote him an email. I said, you know, dear Colonel, all due respect, but that's my column. So he sent 7 members of the SEAL Team Six Force and they opened fire on my house. So what happened though is I get a call from Oliver North, and he to apologize. He said, "I'm so sorry." He explained how it happened, that they people are just grabbing stuff off the internet and putting it up there with his name on it. And he said, "I'd like to make it up to you. Would you like to be on my syndicated radio show on Father's Day?" And I said, "That was the plan." So yeah, so he had me on his show, and as a result, during commercials, most radio guys, when there's a commercial, all you hear is silence. They put you on hold. Ron Jolly always takes a belt of vodka. So so I was on hold, and Oliver North stayed with me, and he chatted with me, which I thought was really high class. And at some point, he said, "Why aren't you syndicated?" And I said, "I don't know. That was always the plan." And he said, I'll call the head of creators for you." And I said, "You know, sure, thank you." And then he did. He called. So I get a call from the head of Creative Syndicate saying, "Well, Oliver North just called me, and it's wise to do whatever Oliver North asks." And he said, "So I'd like to read some of your columns and see if they would work here." And that's how I got nationally syndicated.
So I think your desire, or being a... knowing what you wanted to do and being true to that desire and then working at it through a series of odd jobs, right place, right time. I guess persistence pays off.
Are you saying repossessing cars is odd in any way?
Yeah. How many former repossessors do we have out there? All right, let's talk dogs. How many people read or saw A Dog's Purpose? By applause. I believe we're going to be broadcast. So, how many people cried? How many men cried? I mean, how many men like motorcycles? No. All right. So why dogs? Now you went from this whole gig. You were the father guy, the father of a teenage daughter, and you had that going. And then dogs. What was the first dog book?
First dog book was A Dog's,
A Dog's Purpose.
Yeah.
All right. How'd that come to be?
Well, remember the formula, always write about the obvious. People like dogs. What happened was I was driving up the coast of California with my girlfriend of the time, and she had lost her dog tragically and early, and it had been her first dog. She never had a dog as a child. And you know what happens. You just are not prepared for how much it's going to hurt. And she turns to me and says, "I will never have another dog." And this was really bad news to me, because I was starting to feature this woman in my future plans, if you will. So sometimes when I want to make a point, I'll tell a story. And I told her a story about a reincarnating dog who remembers each life and keeps coming back to the conclusion that it must have a purpose. And it did make her feel better about getting another dog. She liked the story so much she married me. And we do have a dog named Tucker, and Tucker is 24 pounds of suspect DNA. And I have heard from a lot of people that reading A Dog's Purpose somehow helped get past that very bad day, and that we all face when we adopt a dog. So I'm very gratified with the success, but it's funny that it started just with the intention of helping someone cope with grief.
See, I read that book. Oh, I saw the movie first, then I read the book, then I read the new one, A Dog's Way Home, which is outstanding. And Dog Master, I read that. And I thought at some point, I understand my dogs. I walk by my dog, I know what they're thinking now. Because you've become the voice of the dog. Is that what you... I mean, there are a lot of dog books out there. We went through a phase with Marley and me. We had a lot of dog books out there. Mark Levin, anybody who was anybody kind of popped out a dog book. Obviously, they didn't do as well as yours. So yours, I think, is the only one that's narrated by the actual dog. Is that the... secret sauce, or what? How do you explain the huge success?
Yeah, well, mostly Tucker dictated that book to me, so I. the secret, yeah, I think that one of the ways this A Dog's Purpose works, and the sequel is called A Dog's Journey, and they're both for sale here tonight, by the way. And that's not the last time you're going to hear that. The secret is that it's told from a dog's point of view, and it's a real dog. So the dog doesn't really, there are dog books where the dogs understand each other and they understand what the people are saying. They talk to birds and squirrels and things like that. My dog doesn't talk to squirrels. My dog is afraid of cats. My dog runs from plastic bags. So my dog is maybe not that bright. And so my dog just doesn't understand what's going on. But yet these dogs, the joy with which they greet the world is amazing, right? And their forgiveness, there's a joke out there right now that I really like, which says, lock your wife and your dog in your trunk for 4 hours, then go back and open it up and see which one's happy to see you.
So, have you tried that?
No.
What is the appeal? I mean, like, your newest book came out. I was excited because I knew you were coming here. I didn't know about the new book. I walked into Horizon one day and I said, look, what timing? Yeah. Beautiful. This was booked months ago. It was wonderful. And I read A Dog's Way Home, and I knew from the description, the dog and his owner are going to be heartbreakingly separated. And I knew they would be reunited. And yet, I turned those pages. I couldn't wait to go through. So, what do you have any thought about what is the appeal? I mean, is why do we love dogs, or why do we get attached to your stories? You know, the dog is in peril, and you know we're scared, and we're pretty sure he's going to be saved, or we're just so happy when they're reunited and something good. What have you analyzed that at all?
Yeah, I mean, at the risk of selling my book, The Dog Master, which is for sale here tonight. The Dog Master tells the story of the very first wolf to make intimate contact and become domesticated with people. The secret sauce to our survival as a species, I am convinced, is that we adopted this disruptive technology. We had the wolf. So at a time when the ice was storming out of the north to coat the world for the last ice age, and huge, frightening predators were stalking the planet, and we were competing with a Neanderthal force for resources, and the wolves were not our friends. To the wolves, we were a weak, helpless, but tasty source of lunch. At that time, we adopted this technology, and the Dog Master envisions what must have happened for that all to have happened. And then take it a step further and envision that if you had these wild dogs that were becoming domesticated and they didn't like people, we wouldn't let them reproduce. And then also picture that if you're a person and you really like these wolves, you have a better chance of survival yourself. So if Darwin were here, he went to high school with Darwin. If Darwin were here, he would tell you that this symbiotic relationship means we both evolved to be with each other. And that's why we love dogs so instinctively and they love us so much, is because we're literally entwined in our destinies.
Now, The Dog Master is a terrific book. As I read that, I knew all the research you put into it, and I thought, this is nonfiction. This is fascinating. And I had to keep reminding myself it's fiction based on an awful lot of research. What? Give us an idea of what kind of research you did to come up with the... How long ago was that?
A few years ago. A few. 30,000.
A few years ago.
30,000 years ago.
30,000 years ago.
Yeah.
All right, so is it fairly realistic, do you think?
Yeah, I watched a lot of video from that era.
Okay, well, that's... what kind of research did you do to other than video to come up with this idea?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of books about the era. And it's what's really interesting is is there a paleontologist in the house? If you're a paleontologist, you're probably aware of the fact that all the stuff that the common folk that we, you know, casual readers think is absolutely settled science is actually very controversial. There's all kinds of competing theories, and certainly my theory that it was the wolf who enabled us to survive as a species. That's not unique to me, although when I made it up, it was. I later ran across other people who had either copied it from me, which is the most likely, even though their books were published before this. So I guess the bottom line to it is that I read a lot of those books, and but you have to go to your imagination. If you're going to do a book about the Paleolithic, and you're trying to picture what these people are like, and you know that the tallest men on the planet were probably the size of my mom, who's standing up right now because she can't see otherwise. So when you know that, and you're picturing these creatures, including a bear who literally could reach its paw up and bat at those lights, they were huge and they ran at 45 miles an hour. And if you saw one across the field, you might as well lie down. Your last thought would be, "Wow, that is a really big ass bear." So I had to imagine that. So it comes from mostly from the imagination.
How about the social order of the humans of that time? You had a couple of different, three or four different clans in the book. Some were friendly, some were enemies, some were violent, some were predators. But they had this structure where the women's council and all the women would get together and decide who would mate. They would choose what male would mate with which female. And
that's how they did it in junior high school. That's where I got that's where I got that.
And they had a social order. The men were the hunter-gatherers. The women prepared the food and did things like that. Is that pretty accurate, or that their society was like that 30,000 years ago?
We don't have any way of knowing that. What we do know, though, is that people lived in very small tribes because there just weren't enough of us to fill even a decent-sized football stadium. I mean, as a species, we were on the brink of extinction, and so our clans were tiny. I mean, this would be a huge village back then. There wouldn't be this many people. For one thing, there's no way to marshal the resources to feed this many people. They would have to break off into smaller bands. We were nomadic. We hadn't domesticated anything yet, plants nor animals. So what then I imagine was, if you've got an insular group of 15 to 30 people, they would eventually evolve customs, language, religion that was different than the group of humans on the other side of the river. And that is what happens with the Dog Master. I envisioned one tribe as being run by women. It's a matriarchal society. Another one worships the wolf. And so all they are focused on is, what would the wolf do in this situation? And as you said, there's other tribes as well. So it's a flight of the imagination, because we just don't know. But I hope I just by accident stumbled across maybe some of the truth.
Dog Master. Now, is that on sale here tonight?
I believe you're right.
Oh, hey.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up, W. Bruce Cameron addresses the controversy surrounding the alleged mistreatment of a dog on the set of the movie A Dog's Purpose.
Listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return now to Ron Jolly's conversation with novelist W. Bruce Cameron.
All right, we will talk about the new book, A Dog's Way Home. We'll talk about the Repo series and see what else. But if we could get a little glimpse into Hollywood, because you've had a lot of experience there in Hollywood, three movies, really. One's in production, a TV show. A Dog's Purpose, the book comes out, New York Times bestseller, zooms to the top of the list there, and what happened then? Did you go and pitch this somewhere? Did you have an agent? Did a studio come calling to you? How did that turn out? How did that come to be?
Yeah, I wish I could say that I'm a master of that whole universe, but the truth is that, with just one TV show under my belt, and frankly, I wasn't involved with a TV show very much until the final season, So I didn't really have like a high-powered agent, and I didn't really have much going on. What I did have was a friend named Gavin Pallone, who was a producer. He did Zombieland. He did Premium Rush. He's made movies. He's made TV shows. And I sent him the book, actually, to be entirely accurate. He was Catherine Michon, my wife's friend, and she sent him the book and said, you really need to take a look at this, and he fell instantly in love with it. And then we took it around and we pitched it around town, and we had a couple of interested studios, and one of them was DreamWorks. Now they call themselves Amblin, and they called him the moment we walked out of the meeting and said, don't go see anybody else, we want this. And that's how we sold it. But that was a long time ago. That was 2010, and the movie just came out. So that's how that happens.
I can't tell you how many authors I've talked to or read about that had their books optioned, and it goes nowhere. Optioned for a movie, and this one actually got made.
Yeah, this one actually got made. It was fun. It's really fun is I was in a theater the other day, and the movie was playing, and I saw down in the front row there was a woman that had a dog, and the dog is watching the movie. And really seemed to enjoy it. And I went down to her after the movie was over. I went down to her and I said, my gosh, your dog loved that movie. I was amazed. It's just, I'm amazed too. He really didn't care for the book.
Where's the drummer? So the movie, I think the production budget was, 22 mil?
22, yeah.
And they spent
most of that for me. Most of that was straight into my pocket.
And they spent a couple $100 on promotion.
Yeah,
$200-$300 on advertising. And then it went to the movie screens, and it did like 4 million?
Yes.
So if you do the math, that's not bad. But then it went overseas, and it's done a total gross of $190-some million.
Yeah.
So that was after you had been on WTCM with me. I just want to point that out. I mean, that was the
true
plan. All right. So what happens to Bruce Cameron, though, mild-mannered Petoskey native, just writing a newspaper column, hit TV show, New York Times bestseller. Now Hollywood wants to make a movie out of the book. Now it's a huge box office success. Money talks. So are you a bankable guy now? Can you go in to talk to one of these top guys and say, Manny, I've got an idea. Listen to this. Can you get a meeting? Can you get things done? Are you a mover? Shaker?
It's really cute that you think anyone's named Manny
anymore.
Yeah,
okay, there
yeah, I'm here to
Jerry.
Tell. I will tell you that I can get a meeting now. I can get a meeting with a studio if I've got something I want to talk about. That'll happen. And but it's, I can't. Am I a mover and shaker? I don't know. I'm moving and I'm shaking. I don't know.
The new book, I mean, it has movie written all over it. So what's the any nibbles there to get A Dog's Way Home made into a movie?
Yeah, we have been out with the screenplay, and we're getting a lot of interest. It's a very cinematic story, and it's on sale tonight. It's a very because picture this dog, Bella. This dog, Bella, is part pit bull, and is living in Denver. And in Denver, they have this odd rule that if three animal control officers say a dog is a pit bull, then it's a pit bull. And it could be a dachshund. But if they say it's a pit bull, it's a pit bull. And if it's a pit bull, and if it's, it'll be picked up once and they'll tag it as a pit bull. If it's picked up a second time, they euthanize it. And there's no appeal through the system. All you can do is go to court. And then while you're in court, your dog is in the shelter and you have to pay all that money to lawyers and all of that to get your dog out of jail. So Bella's owner, Bella is picked up by an animal control officer. They decide Bella is a pit. All that Lucas, the owner, can think to do with Bella is to send her into the system, get her with a foster family while he tries to find an apartment outside of Denver, which is a little difficult for him to do for reasons that are explained in the book. Bella decides that a horrible mistake has been made. And she's going to rectify that by going home. So she escapes, and she heads home through hundreds of miles of Colorado wilderness, through the Rocky Mountains, a journey that will take her several years and through several adventures. It's a really, though, a It's a book about the bond between us and our dogs and how our dogs always have us at the center of their hearts, and if they can, they will find their way back to us.
Have there been stories similar to that? I mean, I see in the news every now and then you read about a cat that went across the country or a dog. Have you heard of true stories like that?
Yeah, there are lots of true stories like that. I mean, and we don't know how they do it. We know that a dog's nose is the most amazing instrument that you can imagine. A lot of people try to liken it to sight because we see, and so we think, well, if we could see as well as a dog could smell, we could see mane. I don't know why we'd want to look that way, but that's really confusing, though. A much better way is to picture that you have the hearing that is commensurate to, or comparative to a dog's sense of smell. If you had the kind of hearing they have, you could hear a whisper from one state away. That doesn't mean you'd be able to pick it out, though. I mean, I think that's part of what happens with dogs is they have so much information coming in through this primary instrument that to sort it out must take some real doing. But we do think that dogs may have a sense of smell of where they live, and they can just sort of home in on that. We also think that dogs might have a compass, an inner compass, a sense of the true north. Although I've got a compass on my car, and all it does is tell me what direction I'm getting lost in.
So in the new book, A Dog's Way Home, which, now is that on sale here tonight?
I don't know.
Okay.
I had no idea.
They have this dog, Bella, thank you. Bella is raised by cats. Bella lives under a porch of an abandoned building with a family of cats, and the biggest cat he calls his mother. And while he's out in the mountains, I don't want to give a lot away, but he pals around with a cougar or a mountain lion for a little while, a baby mountain lion. Is that realistic based on your research? Would two species like that hang out with each other and sleep together for warmth and feed each other, help with food?
It's realistic based on Facebook.
Well, I mean,
like at least once a day, someone sends me, you know, it's like an ostrich living with an alligator. And I'm like, okay.
But would a dog live, would a mountain, baby mountain lion curl up with a dog?
You know,
have you baby tried that?
I haven't tried that. But baby animals will snuggle up to almost anything except for morning DJs. They have a real instinct against that.
All right. When you write your books, do you cry?
Yes.
Bruce?
I have written myself into tears, yeah.
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 That has to be, see, that's why, you know, to be a talented writer. I mean, to evoke emotion from people, you have to put the right words in the right order. Sounds so easy, but you're able to do that. But it has that impact on you. I mean, you can tell if you're getting it right.
Well, I've tried putting them in the wrong order.
Yeah.
It's just not as effective.
You got to get the right order.
Yes.
If you want to get a movie deal,
well said,
one of the first things there. All right. Hey, back to Hollywood, though. I had a chance to talk to you yesterday, though. And it's this summer, it's Cars 3, it's Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Shrek's probably in there. Spider-Man's coming out.
Fast and Furious 8, 9, and 10.
Yeah, exactly. That seems to be what the money goes into. How do you explain the fact that they made your movie, and what is the current thought of executives in Hollywood? What are they looking for?
It's so cute that you think executives in Hollywood think. There's so much going on in Hollywood, it's really easily explainable. Much smarter people than I have remarked on the fact that the only really reliable group of moviegoers is teenage boys. Like, you know, if you blow up enough stuff, they're going to show up, right? So if you think about the quality of movies, you realize, well, that's because they're so afraid of taking a risk, and if they just blow some stuff up, and especially if it's based on another movie where stuff got blown up, they're going to get a crowd in there, and they're going to sell the movie. And so that's really, like, the paramount thing is they don't want to be the one who made a movie of, say, the life of Ron Jolly, and then nobody came. And they're like, if only we had blown them up, you know?
So they like a good, well-known, established story.
Yeah, they're not willing to take a risk, but This was an attractive project, this A Dog's Purpose, because it could be made for a price, and people like dogs. The script was really well written, and DreamWorks has had a lot of really expensive flops, and they needed to have a movie that would come out that would just put some money in the cash register, and this looked like that kind of movie. They didn't know it was going to be as big as it is, but they thought it would at least make some profit, and they needed, you know, they had BFG, they needed some profit after that debacle.
The obvious, which may come up in Q&A, so I'll just get to it now. When that movie came out, all of us who knew about it anticipated that movie, so excited. I predicted a huge success for that, just a great story, and they had good actors and a good director. And then somebody released this video and claimed that one of the dogs on the set was abused or not looked after properly. How did that impact you? How did you deal with it? And did that story impact the movie in any way?
Yeah, I awoke the morning the story broke. I awoke from somebody from TMZ, got my cell phone, and said, we have video of people drowning a dog on your set. Do you have a comment? And I didn't. I said, let me see what's going on. And then I will tell you a couple of things. The first is first has to do with what I saw. What I saw was a dog that didn't want to go in the water. I didn't see a dog being thrust under. Forced into the water. I saw a dog being lowered who didn't want to go. And when I went public with that interpretation, with no other facts available to me, I was so attacked and reviled. And I got hate mail. I got death threats from people who said that they knew what they saw. But then I went to Amblin and I watched all the film from that day. They just basically showed, and a lot of it was the camera just running while they were getting ready for the next shot. And what happened was that Hercules, the dog, they called him the water dog because he loved the water. And there's so many shots from that day of Hercules straining to get into that pool. But Hercules had been trained for 3 days to jump in the pool from this side. And that's where he got treated, and that, you know, they gave him treats. He was really excited about it. Then the director decided, why don't we try it from that side? So they took Hercules around and they tried to convince Hercules to stand on this platform that was just under the water. So if you'd had a drone and you were looking from overhead, you would have seen two jets of water making it look like the whole thing is a turbulent river. You would have seen that where Hercules was standing, the water was completely calm, and you would have seen about 4 inches under the water a platform, and they're trying to lower Hercules onto the platform. And he didn't want anything to do with that. He's like, I know where I get my treats. It's across on the other side. And so what you see is a dog trying to climb out and say, no, I know what we're doing. Let me do my job. And then, of course, the film is edited. So you see Hercules. You see this guy dunking him in the water. You see it doesn't work. The film jumps to a cut. It was later in the day. And Hercules is down at the drains of this swimming pool, and the current is pushing up against the drain, and he momentarily goes underwater. So he's underwater for exactly 4 seconds because we have another angle on it. 4 seconds, I was unhappy with that, and I felt like they should have done a better job. There were two people with scuba gear under the dog, and there were other people in the pool, so there were a lot of people to make sure the dog didn't drown. I don't know if anybody here has a dog that likes water, but I grew up with Labradors. We would throw things off the dock. They would jump in, and they would go underwater. Our dog, Cammy, you'd put a Frisbee in the water. If it sank, she would go down and get it. She'd be underwater for 20 seconds. So a dog can do this and survive. I certainly wouldn't have wanted this to happen, but it wasn't a threat to the dog's life, as was purportedly the case from the video. Should it have happened? I think they could have done a better job. Was the dog harmed? Absolutely not. There was an investigation. The dog wasn't harmed. Some people insist the dog is terrified when it's being lowered, and when Hercules is being lowered into the water. I think if you think that's terror, you should see my dog Tucker when we're trying to give him a bath. But yeah, it did impact the movie. The movie, we canceled the premiere because there was an organization that said that they would show up and protest, and there were threats against the people and threats against, we were going to have puppies for adoption. There were threats against the the puppies, because this is an organization, I won't mention them, but they believe dogs should not be adopted. They believe that the dogs should actually be euthanized, because if they are with us, they're like slaves, and it's better to be, I guess, a dead slave. Okay, so I'm sorry to bring down the mood in the room, but that was basically what happened. So the final thing is, you know, I got all these death threats. One of them said, I know where you live. I'm going to come kill you, and I'm going to come kill your kids. And I said, if you're going to come after my kids, two out of three of them, I bet on my kids. You know, I got one who's nice, but the other ones are really mean.
So I thought the way that was released in typical kind of tabloid, trashy TV fashion, that it would not have any impact, or as they say, any PR is good PR. I don't think a lot of people who read the book and know you would believe that, and you could tell it was edited. But it did obviously had an impact. I was surprised.
Yeah, I think it impacted the domestic box office. I think we were trending to hit 100, and we hit 60. Okay. You know, that's just, I will say that I think that something good came out of it, which is every live-action movie made from now on is going to be made with the belief that there's someone there taping it. Because I guarantee you the guy who sold the tape made a lot of money on it. So from now on, if they were already trying to do their absolute best, they're going to have to do even better. They're just going to have to. So, and I'm okay with that.
Well, was that a disgruntled person, or did that person really believe the dog was in some type of danger?
I can't imagine someone standing there with a camera if you really thought the dog was in. If I thought the dog was in danger, I would have been in the pool. And I can't imagine anybody just standing there with a camera taking a shot and not doing anything to help a dog if they really thought it was in danger.
All right. Dogmaster, which is on sale outside those doors,
just
right there.
Over there.
And that is the book that Bruce did a lot of research on and goes back 30,000 years to the first domestication of a wolf, and fascinating book. At one time you said to me, it's Game of Thrones. We've got a pitch into HBO. And I thought, after I read the book, that would be a great series on HBO or any network with dogs. It's the Game of Thrones with dogs, sort of. What's the status? Have you ever tried to get that produced?
We are working really hard. The status is that it's going to be so expensive. I mean, the bear that I the short-faced bear, the one that I was talking about that's the size of an elephant, or these pantheras, the extinct lion of Asia that shoulder to shoulder with a man and had paws the size of pie plates, we're not going to be able to find those. So we're going to have to make CGI of all the animals, and that's going to be very expensive to be real. I mean, I just wouldn't want to be associated with something where the animals didn't look real. So this is all above my pay grade, but they're out looking for a substantial amount of investment. They certainly, we wrote the pilot. My wife and I wrote the pilot. I'm really proud of it. I think it would be a great TV show, and I hope that you are someday a Hollywood executive and you can greenlight that thing.
I'll think about it.
Yeah, you think about that.
All right, we have time for one more question, and then think about if anybody out there has a question for Bruce. We'll have someone running around with a microphone. The Repo Man, the Midnight Plan of the Repo Man, and then there was a follow-up.
Yes, Repo Madness.
Repo Madness. Set in Kalkaska, Antrim County, Charlevoix County. Fun reads, a little bit of a mystery. By the way, there's a little reincarnation in there, too. Is that a thing with you?
That's kind of a thing, yeah.
Kind of a thing, reincarnation. Can you give us an idea of, you went from fatherhood to the dog books and all that, and thought, I'm going to write a little fun mystery book about Northwest Michigan, about a repo man, which you did at one time. What was the idea behind that? Why did you write that book?
Well, when I was a repo man, it occurred to me that I was something like a private detective. I was always trying to find people who didn't want to be found, or at least find their cars. And it was a lot of detective work. It was a lot of asking questions. And so I always thought it would make for a really interesting detective story if a repo man had to use his considerable skills to locate a murderer, or to solve a mystery. And so that's the Midnight Plan of the Repo Man is the first in the series. Repo Madness is the second. It is the story of this guy, Ruddy McCann, who lives in Kalkaska, Michigan, and spends a lot of his time in places like Traverse City. If you read these books, I think you'll really enjoy them. You'll recognize a lot of the places. I even name restaurants and local haunts like that. And of course, the books are kind of funny. I mean, the characters are funny. The situations are kind of funny. I think I'm really proud of it. I think it's among my best work.
I have one last question. Those two books, are they on sale here tonight?
Oddly, yes.
Okay, there we go. Well, I want to thank Bruce for coming to Traverse City and for your time. Thank you. And Bruce's mom, wherever she may be.
Monsey Cameron, would you stand up so everybody can see who you are?
Oh, there we go.
Here she comes. There's mom.
Thank you.
And also sitting in the same row is former Teacher of the Year, my sister Amy Cameron. Very proud of her as well. Stand up, Amy. There's Amy.
So does anybody have a question for right over there?
Hi,
please,
Bruce.
Talk close to the microphone.
Okay. Welcome back to Traverse City.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. We're at the table out in the lobby for Michigan Writers, and I wondered, with all the people in the audience who want to write and are looking at that, whether it's for leisure or professionally, can you talk about what it's like to write funny? That people often really underestimate how difficult that is, but how you've learned to do that?
Several years ago, I was shutting the door to my van, and I shut it on my fingers. That's what it's like to write humor. I've been on panels where they've announced, we're going to teach you how to be funny, and I go up there and I say, you either are funny or you're not. It helps to have really dysfunctional parents. But in the end, you just have to have that in you. And there are a lot of people who, I was talking to Dave Barry, of all people, about this, and Dave Barry kind of vented about what he called so-called humor, because he works so hard to lay a joke just right, you know. And I know what that's like, to keep rewriting the sentence because it's not quite as funny. It's a funny line, but it's not quite as funny. And then he'll see someone toss out a funny situation. You know, it's funny if you wake up in the morning and your dishwasher ran all night and there's 2 inches of soapy water in the kitchen, but that's a funny situation. That's not a joke. And you can make funny jokes about that, I suppose. But a lot of people don't understand the difference. So that would be what I would tell a writer, is know the difference between something that is said funny and something that is funny, but it's not. But you haven't written it funny. And then stop writing, because I've got enough competition as it is.
You could read Bruce's autobiography on the website. What's your website?
WBruceCameron.com. I've got my autobiography up there. It was written by me.
All right, we have another question up here on aisle left.
Hi. This is not so much a question as it is a comment. My son Mitchell is too shy to speak for himself, but he wanted to tell you thank you so much for writing A Dog's Purpose, because I read it as part of my book club and caved and immediately got a dog for the family. And he is not a reader, but we are now reading A Dog's Purpose together, and he very quickly volunteered to come with me this evening.
What's your son's name?
Mitchell.
You owe me, Mitchell.
Yes, upstairs in the balcony.
Hello.
Hi.
I've only read A Dog's Purpose, but I was wondering how you decided, you know, there are certain things the dog can know, and then certain things the dog has to know in order to be able to narrate the story. How did you go about deciding what would be unknowable to the dog and what would be known?
See, we're not taking questions from people who've only bought one book.
That's funny.
But we do have books on sale in the lobby. This was actually really hard to do. I thought, I'm going to write from a dog's point of view. How hard can it be? All I have to do is get into the mind of the dog. And to do that, I did things like I carried a tennis ball around in my mouth. I went over and humped the neighbor's leg. I thought, you know, this is, I can get into this, but it was actually really hard. If you think about it, there's so many things that we consider to be common references, like I waited for 10 minutes. But a dog's not going to wait for 10 minutes. That doesn't know what a minute is. To a dog, 10 minutes might feel like forever. And I found myself unwriting so many references that I made that seemed so, you know, a dog will respond to something a human said. And I thought, yeah, but the dog doesn't actually understand what was said. So it was hard. I mean, taking on this thing of writing from the dog's point of view, as I've done, hasn't been my favorite because of how hard it is. So that was only a partial answer, I realized, but you've only bought one book.
All right. We have another question up front here.
Just a brief one. You have a number of unpublished novels, and even though they're unpublished, are they for sale in the lobby?
All right, you caught me. You got me with that one. I will sell them to you, sir. Thank you. That was funny.
I know I shouldn't ask this question, but how do you like to be described? As a humor writer, do you mind being called, oh, that's the guy that wrote the dog books? Do you have a preference?
Devastatingly handsome. remarkably witty. That's a great question, Ron. I'm not actually sure. I'm not sure that I would have a favorite way to be described, because what I really like to hear from people is that my book touched them, it moved them, especially if it moved them to adopt a dog from an animal shelter like the Humane Society is here tonight. There are so many dogs who, through our negligence, remember the thesis of the Dog Master for Sale in the Lobby is that we carved these animals to our will. We made the dachshund. We made the shih tzu. They weren't natural. I mean, we bred dogs for our specific purposes. They are entirely reliant on us. It's almost impossible for a dog to survive in the wild. There's almost nothing in America that resembles a feral dog. There are some, but and they're in packs, of course, and it's very rare, and they're usually around a lot of trash, because that's all they can do. They can't really hunt effectively. So we owe it to these animals to support them. They can't fend for themselves. And the reason why we have such a population explosion is that people are not responsibly spaying and neutering their pets when they adopt them. And these dogs are like an eighth grade boy. They're very focused on one thing when they pick up that scent. And so we have a lot of dogs being born into the world that have no hope of survival if humans don't step forward and save them. So I would urge you to consider, if you don't have a dog in your life and you've got room for one, go adopt a dog. Go find a dog in a shelter. And by the way, if you go to a shelter, your dog will find you. Ah.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody for being here, and thank you again, Mr. W. Bruce Cameron.
Thank you.
That was W. Bruce Cameron talking with Ron Jolly. Cameron's latest novel is Repo Madness. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlockin Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milcarrick.